Goddess Grove. We'd spent the day being measured, tested in many ways, and trained in simple deportment, how to answer any and all questions with modesty and respect, and how to eat and fetch with our teeth and not our hands. We were together some of the time and at other times not. We were given potions to drink and studied for our behavior afterwards. One potion inflamed me so miserably that I wept. Another potion made me sleep at once. In a yard, we were made to trot in a circle around a central pillar and spanked hard as we did it. And then we were groomed meticulously, our nails being trimmed. And I was shaved more than once by the gentlest barbers. But not my pubic hair, or any body hair. My pubic hair was carefully groomed, fluffed, even curled a bit here and there, though it was curly enough already. At last, at dark, we were assembled with 10 other new slaves to be anointed. The Goddess Grove was venerable, ancient, we were told. It had fallen into ruin in the old kingdom, but our new monarchs had restored it. Our procession moved silently through the great gardens and then out and down a broad path towards it with lighted torches. Many lords and ladies watched. It was a place of thick, soft grass and abundant flowers. A great half-circle of arches in the grove held some 12 antique statues, some broken, some whole, of gods and goddesses. Flickering lamps illuminated each of these figures or groupings. I knew Aphrodite spanking her disobedient Cupid with a sandal, and Dionysius and the great god Pan. I knew Apollo as he tried to capture Daphne, and Priapus. Yes. Others I could not identify. The grass was cool, and torches were flaring everywhere, but the light was shadowy, and an air of mystery enveloped us. The king and queen came into the grove and received each of us by name, for kisses and embraces, and we were prompted to repeat our vows to serve in our own words. Sybil was positioned some distance from me, but I got a good glimpse of her, and she looked glorious. Her hair never more lustrous and beautifully groomed with flowers and jewels. Then, as the Lord High Chamberlain held the oils for the king, we were anointed as slaves of the realm by the king's thumbprint on our foreheads, and the queen decorated our heads with green garlands. Lady Eva came forward to anoint our private parts and claim them for the pleasure of the realm, as indeed our entire persons were claimed. There was the strong, sweet smell of gardenias and lilies everywhere, and we were made to kneel down before our sovereigns to receive their final blessing. The king wished us a long life in the kingdom and reminded us of our protections and promises. His voice was natural and sincere, as if he trusted completely to the words themselves. There was no cloying artificiality. "Tomorrow," said my groom as he led me away, "you'll be a plaything of the king, and mark you, scramble to obey his slightest command. To be the king's pet is a great honor."
Chapter 10. Beauty. The Agony of Lord Stefan. 1. He was a man of good height, clean-limbed and well-built, with a gentle, appealing face and eyes of near-perfect cobalt blue that made beauty think of fine-glazed porcelain. He had a youthful manner, not becoming of necessity in a man of his age, but not off-putting either. Beauty liked it. And in his narrow face and almond-shaped eyes, Beauty could see something of the late Queen Eleanor, his first cousin. But his real charm lay in his fine manners and his vibrant and tender voice, coupled with a thoughtful reticence. That one so handsome should seem so unaware of it. Well, that too had its appeal, and perhaps united all of the other seductive traits he possessed in the eyes of beauty. "Lord Stefan, please, be at your ease," Beauty said. She sat opposite him at the table, the morning sun spilling down into her private parlor from the high-arched windows. "You need hold nothing back from me, my lord. I am your queen. I am listening." It was plain he wanted to open his soul. Tears hovered in his eyes suddenly, and Tristan, who sat beside him, Tristan, who was taller, stronger, and so much more imposing, reached out for Lord Stefan as he might to a younger brother. Long years ago, when Beauty and Tristan had been slaves together on their return voyage from the Sultanate, Tristan had told her all of his love for this diffident and sweet lord who had failed to be Tristan's master. And Beauty had forgotten none of the story. Lord Stefan and Tristan had known each other and loved each other before Tristan was brought as a bound and naked slave to the feet of Queen Eleanor. What a disaster that she'd given Tristan over to the fearful and anxious Lord Stefan to master. Lord Stefan's hair was a golden brown, exquisitely highlighted by the sun, and that he wore it very long and very full gave him a slight suggestion of the feminine. But his shaven beard and mustache were thick and had left a dark shadow on his face, attesting to his virility. And then there was the touch of hair on the backs of his wrists and even on his long fingers, and the depth of his voice, so like a smooth, thick syrup when he spoke. But then what about the exquisite character of his dress? His lace shirt studded with tiny pearls, and the heavy slashed balloon sleeves that covered it with the lining of violet silk? It was all rather confusing. Virility, femininity. For Beauty, they had more to do with a subtle presentation of self than any physical attributes. And in Lord Stefan's eyes, Beauty saw timidity and anguish that might belong to any soul, regardless of gender. As for his slave, Becca. What an icy and merciless gaze she cast on him from her place in the corner, where, naked and still, she rested back on her heels, gazing at him. Her breasts were almost too big to be beautiful, but not quite. And her mouth was not cruel, but coldly perfect. Her flaxen hair, parted in the middle, made Beauty think of her own hair. She had an oval face, not unlike Beauty's face as well, and large, well-shaped hands. She sat there utterly still as if she controlled every fiber of her physical being. Her eyes were paler than those of her master, an ice blue as vivid as the coral tint of her lips and her nipples. She put Beauty in mind of a white panther, if such a thing existed. A sleek white cat the size of a human.
"Your Majesty," said Lord Stefan, "I cannot bear it any more. I am unable to pretend any longer. In the last years of the Old Kingdom, I died on the vine like everyone else. No, Tristan, don't protest. I did. You know I did. I might as well have lived in any kingdom or no kingdom at all. I kept to my chambers with Becca. And it was a farce, I tell you, whenever we appeared together before others."
Beauty understood. "Of course." But she didn't say so. "I am living my own farce," she thought. "Pretending that I love wielding the paddle and the strap. Pretending that I delight in the submission of others. I admire it and I envy it, but I don't delight in it. I delight in the glory of the court, the realm, the well-run kingdom of Belavaltin, the kingdom they now call Beauty's Kingdom. But I don't delight in anyone's submission. It does not send my blood rising. But this Beauty had confessed to no one, and she did not confess it now. Of course, Laurent knew. Laurent knew Beauty as he knew himself. And he had always known how to handle her, take her, thrill her, and leave her satisfied. But they had never really spoken of it. Not in the old days before the gates of the kingdom came crashing shut behind them. And now, in the midst of the great revival of the immense court that swirled around them, Laurent assured Beauty that she must, in all things, please herself.
"If it does not come naturally to you to enjoy disciplining slaves," he'd said, "then don't do it, my darling. Leave it to Lady Eva. Leave it to me. Leave it to your grooms. Who says that you must enjoy wielding the paddle? You are queen here, Beauty, not Eleanor. Eleanor is gone.
All those around you long only to make you happy day and night."
But Beauty had not been entirely comforted by Laurent's words. She wanted a deeper immersion in the thrilling complexities of the kingdom, and held herself to be too timid and unsure. She struggled now to clear her mind and look at Lord Stefan, who was in such need of her.
"And how so is it all a farce, my lord?" she asked him.
Uppermost in her thoughts was the resolve to listen, to be attentive, to comfort, and to solve the problem of this soul who depended so upon her.
"I long to serve,"
said Lord Stefan in a tremulous voice. He looked directly into her eyes. That was hardly difficult for her or anyone, thought Beauty. For what did her eyes say but that she wanted so to help him?
"My queen, I long to serve with all my heart. I always have. My cousin, the late queen, despised me utterly for it, forbade me ever to speak of it, to her or to others, excoriated me for my unseemly weakness."
Beauty said nothing. Tristan leaned closer to his friend, the fingers of his left hand gently cradling Lord Stefan's shoulder. Nothing quivered at all in the alabaster face of the feline Becca. Indifferent as a cat, as secretive and aloof.
"Go on, my lord. Tell me all," said Beauty. Her heart went out to Stefan.
"You know, there was an old custom in the kingdom that on Midsummer Eve, those of the court who wanted to be slaves could become slaves, but only to be sent to the village. And the queen forbade me from ever disgracing the royal family by such a step, threatening me with banishment if I were even to suggest it. And so I kept my peace, and I lived as one condemned to burn with passion forever without respite, and did what I could, sought what I could in secret."
His eyes shifted, lighted upon Becca, and then veered away as if he had been slapped. He looked to Beauty.
"Your Majesty, now that the new kingdom blossoms like a magic garden planted and watered by the wise women of legend, I am in ever-increasing agony."
"My lord, what would you like me to do?"
asked Beauty.
"Hasn't my lord, the king, set up a manor house where you might go to seek the discipline you so crave, without judgment?"
"Oh, how I should like to go there myself."
"Yes, my queen. And it was very generous of the king to allow this,"
Stefan replied.
"Nonsense, my lord. The king was happy to allow it. And I am happy that it is allowed. We do not conform to the ideas of the late Queen Eleanor."
"My queen,"
Tristan said. He spoke softly, haltingly, waiting for Beauty's permission to continue. She nodded at once, and he went on.
"What Stefan wants is to come to live with me permanently in my household."
"Ah, well, why not?" said Beauty. "I can see no reason to prohibit it."
"But
as my naked slave, said Tristan, entirely subject to my authority and bound to me for 6 months like any postulant to the kingdom, and thereafter for years of his own free will and mine.
Ah, well, I see no objection to it whatsoever, said the queen. And my lord, the king, has entrusted this matter entirely to me and won't question my decision. Why not, Lord Stefan? Why not?
Lord Stefan sat back and closed his eyes. A long shudder passed through him. Obviously, he was overcome with gratitude. Yet he was afraid. He was tense. He was still anxious.
But you do realize, my lord, said Beauty, that this may be far more difficult for you than you now realize.
I have explained the terms on which I will accept this, said Tristan gently, gesturing with his open palm. I have told Stefan that there will be no special rules for him, or special allowances.
And you are right. There cannot be any special allowances, said Beauty. For the discipline of the kingdom is the citadel of all slaves and their masters or mistresses.
I understand, my queen, said Lord Stefan. I have every confidence that Tristan, my new master, will allow no half-measures.
A deep blush came over Stefan's face. He glanced at Tristan, then lowered his eyes.
Such pain, such fear.
And Stefan understands as well, said Beauty, that he will not be shielded from the eyes of others in any certain safety in your house, does he not, Tristan? He cannot be closeted away there with any guarantee of perfect privacy. Once he becomes a slave of the kingdom, inevitably this will be known, and someone, sooner or later, someone of his former kith or kindred, will see him in his new state. From that he cannot be protected. It is a practical fact as well as a matter of propriety. No slave is given special concealment. Tristan glanced at Stefan.
I do understand,
said Stefan under his breath, gazing at the queen. But she could see the timidity, the uncertainty.
He is taller than me, Beauty thought, yet he tilts his head so that he is looking up at me. That is his manner, always to be looking up even at those who are shorter, smaller than he is. Very pretty, and in a slave, irresistibly charming.
Frankly, it terrifies me, said Lord Stefan. I cannot but think of being seen by those at court. I cannot bear to think of ever being brought into the gardens and displayed. I cannot bear to think of those who'd supped with me and talked with me and hunted with me and lived with me, suddenly having me naked and at their feet. But I have no choice but to pursue this path, and I have no hope except that Tristan will bring me along with gentleness and indulgence and some mercy on me for my fears. I cannot...
He broke off helplessly. Tristan nodded silently at Beauty. There was a trace of a smile on his full lips. His blue eyes were filled with patience and understanding, and when he embraced Stefan again, it was tenderly.
Well, my lord, said Beauty, no man in the kingdom knows more of what it means to master and to serve. No man except the king than Prince Tristan.
Yes, my queen, said Lord Stefan.
His eyes were thick with tears.
I am so grateful to you.
Then why are you still so miserable, thought Beauty. And why am I so afraid for you?
And may I then take my Lord Stefan with me now?
Asked Tristan.
My servants may pack up all that belongs to him and store this safely in my house. And then we need trouble you no more with this.
Ah, not quite so simple, said the queen. She was thinking, pondering, thinking of all the great ways of Bellavolton and the principles that lay behind them. She looked at the cold and comely Becca, who was staring forward as before, as if she heard nothing when in fact she heard everything. "I shall tell you how it will be," Beauty said. "In that you have come to me for an innovation, I shall set the terms of it." Her eyes moved idly over the distant window and over the many objects of the room waked by morning sun as she continued speaking. "Given that you are who you are, I shall arrange it for you. Now, tonight or tomorrow night or the night after, Tristan, you decide. The king and I, before the usual grand feast, will come down to your manor house, and there, in a garden grove or fountain court of your choosing, you will present your new and naked slave to us for anointing. We will hear his vows, to serve with his whole heart for 6 months, and then we shall leave him to you. And then it is in your hands, Prince, as to when, if ever, you bring him into the great gardens of the castle with you, or what you do with him on all accounts." No one spoke, but the casual lift of Beauty's right hand held them in abeyance.
"In 3 nights," said Tristan earnestly. "Please, my queen, give me 3 nights to work with him before he's to be anointed. I can turn him out beautifully in 3 nights, surely."
Looking around the room as before, Beauty continued. "Very well. 3 nights it shall be. But he must be anointed."
"Yes, my queen."
"And I give you now the benefit of my experience." She lowered her voice as if to underscore the importance of her words. "Be strict, very strict. And don't wait too long, Tristan, to bring your obedient slave to court. And whip your charge yourself along the castle bridle path." Lord Stefan flinched. He stared forward, his lips quivering. Beauty caught this, though she was not looking directly at him. "Choose a late hour if you like," said Beauty, looking at the distant window. "When not many are about, for the first time. It doesn't matter, but don't wait too long. And at the end of 6 months, I trust to your judgment that this must be a perfect novice to take his vows for another 2 years. Do not present him for that moment if he is truly unworthy." Silence. Slowly, Beauty turned and looked at Lord Stefan. The color had drained from his face and he was staring at her. His mouth, so tender and boyish, so vulnerable, was still quivering. But there was a wild gleam in his eyes that was more than his tears sparkling in the sunlight.
"I understand," said Tristan. "I understand completely. And if I cannot put Stefan forward as a worthy slave at the end of 6 months..."
"Well, then that will require extraordinary measures," said Beauty. "A period of retirement, perhaps, from the kingdom, or a year of gentle imprisonment in Lord Stefan's old quarters. I do not know which. I cannot say. But I say only that Lord Stefan will not be permitted to serve if he cannot serve, any more than any other slave who fails at it. And we shall have no hybrids here, no creatures who are half slave and half master. We shall have no breakdown of ritual or discipline which could spell ruin for all. What I allow, I will allow. But it shall be enshrined for all to know, and shall have its consistency and its principles." She sighed. "I owe this," she said, "to every single slave in the realm. I owe this to every single master as well."
"I understand," Tristan hastened to say again.
"Lord Stefan?" Beauty looked at him expectantly.
"Yes, my queen."
Lord Stefan said. His voice was low. He swallowed.
I am your grateful servant.
Be certain you do understand.
Yes, my queen.
His voice was barely audible. But she would settle for it.
My queen, I've had years to think on this, years to suffer over it, years to dream of a moment such as this.
Beauty nodded. She smiled.
You may go, my lords, she said. On the third night, at dusk, prince, have your slave ready for us. The Lord Chamberlain will appear with us bearing the sacred oils for the anointing. They were on their feet, both of them, bowing to Beauty.
And what of this grave Egyptian cat here? Asked Beauty, pointing to Becca.
I shall give her over to Lord Gregory, my queen, said Stefan without so much as a glance at Becca.
No affection there, obviously.
Unless your majesty wishes me to do something else to make future arrangements for her. She's served faithfully and well for 2 years.
He clearly didn't want to say more or reveal more, and he was not going to look at Becca.
I shall see to her, then. Leave me.
Beauty turned again towards the window. She loved the play of the sun on the furnishings of the room, on the ornate silver vessels on the sideboard, on the mirrors in their gilded frames, on the polished wood of the bed, the chairs, the table. Slowly, her eyes fixed on Becca, who at once glanced down, though it was plainly obvious she'd been studying Beauty. How cool and unruffled she appeared, her breasts heaving just a little. Then slowly Becca looked up, and unbidden spoke in a deep, cold voice, her eyes burning as she stared at Beauty. And now shall I be your harsh and secret mistress as well? She sneered. Beauty was silently stunned. She marveled, but she held the girl's gaze effortlessly.
Don't be a fool, my girl, said Beauty calmly.
At once, Becca looked down and the fingers of her right hand began to tremble.
So that is all it takes, thought Beauty. Just that little show of strength and dominance, and she is undone, is she?
I know your game, said Beauty in the same calm voice.
I know what your service to Lord Stefan has been like. You were given a chance when we took the twin crowns to declare whether you chose to remain. And choose to remain, you did. But you were your master's secret mistress then, his secret tormentor. And obviously, for all the latitude allowed you by your lord, you didn't teach him to love you or to need you. The girl made not a sound, but her face changed completely. Her eyes grew bright and then narrowed, and her lips moved. And then she bit her lower lip, but nothing else about her changed.
Yes, my queen,
she whispered. It was a low, fearful whisper. A terrible sadness came over her face as she stared at the floor, or perhaps at Beauty's slippers.
Well, now that the unique conditions of your life have changed, said Beauty, I give you another chance to leave the kingdom. Is that what you want? I'll see that you're dressed, paid out, and gone before dusk. Or would you have another night or so to contemplate your decision?
Silence. The sun was moving high in the sky, and the entire chamber was filled now with light. The mirrors were sheets of reflected gold, and a great starburst of light emanated from one of the jeweled goblets set out on the sideboard.
No, my queen, said Becca. I need no further time to decide. Forgive me.
You're in my hands as you were before? Asked Beauty.
She drew her eyes away from the sparkling goblet and looked at the girl.
Yes, my queen. Inalterably. Forever.
Ah,
Now that is a tone I like, said Beauty. She made it a point to be polite. She took no exultation in the girl's miscalculation. Ring the bell there for my attendant. The girl obeyed, quickly pulling the long embroidered sash that hung beside the bed, and then she returned to her former position. There was a bloom to her cheeks, and a small blue vein throbbed in her temple. Her hands were definitely trembling.
My queen,
she whispered, her head bowed, her dark, smoky eyebrows drawn together in obvious distress.
May I speak?
Yes, you may. But be wise when you do, said Beauty.
I am so sorry that I have offended you.
Well, I know precisely why you did and what you thought, Beauty mused to herself, but she said nothing.
I beg to be restored to your good graces.
The young attendant Tyrus appeared, who had become Beauty's favorite of late, the boy who knew just how to make all things pleasant for her and how to fulfill her wishes. A freckled boy with tousled strawberry blonde hair, he did not possess great beauty, but was profoundly appealing with his sweet smile, ruddy cheeks, and his natural tendency to protect and support the queen in all matters great and small. And others did speak of him all the time as delectable. Tyrus, send a messenger to the village and to Prince Dimitri. Ask the prince to come to my chambers here. Tell him, when he arrives, that he is to take this girl under his authority. She wondered if the girl understood the implications of this summons. Only two nights ago, she'd seen Prince Dimitri, resplendent in his glistening tunic of bodkin, attending to his duties as the minister of the place of public punishment. She'd seen his fierce scowling face and swift gestures as he spanked a quivering slave boy furiously towards the public turntable. She'd heard his strict and menacing voice as he'd pulled the boy up to look into his flinching eyes.
Play games with me. I'll see that every ounce of rebellion is purged from you.
The captain of the guard on the sidelines had been the picture of admiration.
He's a terror, he confided to Beauty. He's perfect. He descends on them like a windstorm.
Yes, Laurent had said as he stood idly by with Alexei and Lady Eva.
A windstorm of blows and carefully chosen words. And words do mean so very much in the proper training of slaves.
Everyone, from the whipping masters to the lowliest grooms, Alexei had said, to the humblest villager and the greatest lord is in his thrall. He's made of mundane punishments a knightly pageant. Becca, though her hands trembled and her eyes were glazed, gave no indication that she knew what awaited her. But then, thought Beauty, she is very clever. Clever enough to know I share Lord Stefan's inclinations. She knows, and therefore likely she has heard and seen much, and perhaps she is resigned to it. I'm giving you to Prince Dimitri, Beauty said, and only when he tells me that you are chastened and tuned to a new song will I summon you back to court.
Yes, my queen,
the girl whispered. She started to say something else, but stopped. Pray, continue, Beauty said. Say what you will while you have the chance with me.
My fault is one of bitterness,
the girl said. Her voice was thick now, quite a change from her iron tone earlier.
I am guilty of resenting my former master.
This was a shocking admission. Yet it came easily to her as if some faith in the truth of her words guided her. Her forehead was creased with an anguished frown. I know, said Beauty. I understand quite completely. And that's why I gave you an opportunity to reaffirm your decision for the kingdom. Trust in me that the kingdom will not fail you. tears. The girl could hold them back no longer. But this reply had taken her aback. She was unsettled.
"Come here to me, Becca," said Beauty.
Becca approached on her hands and knees, and Beauty received her with tender gestures, pressing the girl's face gently into her lap. She stroked the girl's thick, fair hair, so like her own, and her flawless, naked back.
"Come," she said softly. "Kiss me."
At once, Becca obeyed, rising up on her knees and offering her mouth to Beauty. Her kiss was firm, not yielding, an unhurried offering of intense fervor. And Becca's long hair mingled with Beauty's hair.
"Such a reservoir of devotion to be drunk from this precious cup," said Beauty.
She smoothed Becca's hair back from her forehead, and the girl's eyes fixed on her, as if deliberately inviting reprimand.
"Yes," the girl whispered. "Oh, yes, my beloved queen. And he never wanted it, never asked for it, never."
She stopped, ashamed, and broke into silent sobs. She closed her eyes and waited, it seemed, for what might come.
Such anguish. "I know, my darling. I understand."
There was an air to Becca of utter silent submission. Submission to the moment, submission to Beauty, submission to the kingdom. But more significant, submission to her own nature, her own soul. Gradually, she opened her eyes. A deeply probing expression came over Becca, and she searched Beauty's face.
"If only I might take my time myself with you," said Beauty. "But there are others now waiting on me, more decisions to be made, audiences to be given. Don't take lightly your time in Prince Dimitri's hands. Don't be so foolish as to waste what he offers you. I deliver you to him with love of you, my dear, as certainly as I have delivered your master to Prince Tristan. You understand?"
"My queen," the girl said.
The words came out like a deep sigh. Without permission, she inclined towards Beauty and carefully lay her head on Beauty's shoulder. Beauty found her huge breasts irresistible. She lifted Becca and moved her back so that she might kiss her breasts slowly, savoring the texture and fragrance of the skin. The coral nipples were like raisins. Vaguely, it occurred to her that Becca might have gotten from Beauty precisely what Becca wanted.
"Of course," she smiled. "How could Beauty have confused or surprised one so experienced?"
The girl's limpid grace and thoughtful expression intrigued her. She longed to lay bare the complexities locked within the girl, the subtle entangled secrets that Lord Stefan likely had never found compelling.
"No," said Beauty.
"You won't waste Prince Dimitri's precious heat, will you? Because you yourself know what it means to have been wasted." The softest, bitter laugh came from the girl's lips. Not a challenge, but an affirmation. She smiled and her eyes closed, and tears welled from under her long lids, and she said again,
"My queen,"
as Beauty kissed her.
The mysteries of her own heart troubled Beauty.
But she knew that, whatever the case, she had done right this morning by this girl and by Lord Stefan and by her beloved Tristan. And if that was so, then she had done right by herself, her troubled and tremulous self. Slowly, she extricated herself from Becca's embrace and gestured for her to kneel in the customary place beside the hearth. It was an agony to let her go, to see her drawing away, to lose the warmth and fragrance of her. A most important conference had been called this morning. Beauty must dress for this, and for the audiences in the great hall after it. So many demands. But then such was her life, and she was eager for it. She rose and moved past the girl indifferently and into her small parlor. There on her writing desk were her sheets of parchment and her ink and quills trimmed and prepared by Terius. Beauty sat down in the small carved chair and began to write. Prince Dimitri, this is a proud and haughty girl, thoroughly spoiled, but capable of reformation. The harshest and most effective instruments of the village are recommended. I commit her to your authority and your judgment for as long as you think best. And she is not to be returned unless she has completely surrendered to your utmost satisfaction. To this, Beauty signed her name quickly and then blotted the note carefully. She rolled the stiff page into a small tight scroll, binding it with one of the many scarlet ribbons laid out for the purpose. Then, into a small silver cylinder, she placed the note, and with a bit of wax in the impress of her ring, she sealed the cap of the cylinder. She approached the girl, who had not moved an inch from her former position. Something about the girl from the back made her think of herself. It was not only the flaxen hair, it was the girl's size and proportions. They were made from the same physical mold, it seemed, Beauty and this girl. Though how different Becca was in temperament. "Kneel up and open your mouth," she said. At once Becca did as she was commanded. Beauty slipped the silver cylinder sideways into her mouth like a bit. The girl was shocked. Clearly no one had put a gag or a bit into her mouth in a very long time. But she held the cylinder between her teeth obediently. She began to shiver. Tyrius had only just returned.
"The message has been sent, my queen."
"Give the little parcel here to the prince when he comes," she said. "My instructions are there." She pointed to the cylinder. Becca's eyes were squeezed shut and she was crying. "Yes, she is so like me," thought Beauty suddenly. This girl tugged at her heart. But Beauty only smiled. "I know what she needs," she thought. "I shall not fail her any more than I have failed Lord Stefan." 2. Outside the council chamber, Beauty paused. She could hear the busy voices of those within. She knew that she was late. So many decisions had to be made. There was so much business every day. But she waited. She stood quiet, her attendants waiting unquestioningly behind her, and her beloved pet, Bren, kneeling on all fours at her side. Why had she not punished Becca for impertinence herself? It would have been easy enough to do. She knew how to wield the paddle. Why had it not given her pleasure to think of disciplining the girl into submission, the way she herself had once been schooled in submission, through pain and pleasure? Beauty had surrendered utterly and sublimely to her punishments, glorying in them, grateful for cold, implacable authority as much as for affection, grateful for severity as for ardor, hungering for engulfing discipline as much as love. She had been tempted, yes, for just a moment. But the girl, for all her anxiety and confusion, had not really captured Beauty's keen interest. If Beauty were ever to wield the paddle and the strap with passion, it would be for a slave more like this one, Bren, whose stout soul bewitched her. A slave she could break in the name of perfection rather than mere correction. A slave whose lust for discipline was his lure. And who knew? Perhaps someday she could do this. She did not know. As she looked down at Bren, at his soft curly black hair and straight shoulders, a shadow fell over her,
and she woke from her thoughts to see the king standing there.
"What is it, dearest?"
Laurent whispered. "We're all waiting." "Just the usual matters, nothing more." When she did not answer, Laurent spoke to the slave beside her. "Bren, you go in now and kneel by the queen's chair." He motioned to the attendants to leave them as well. At once Bren moved to obey, and the king and queen, outside the doors to the council chamber, were alone.
"Beauty, what is it?"
Laurent asked.
"You're not still troubled by self-doubts, are you, my lovely one?"
Beauty wished she could find words to answer, to explain.
"Forgive me, my lord," she said. "I'm coming better to understand myself every day."
"I have always understood you," said Laurent. "You cannot be all things to all subjects, Beauty. You can only love them in your own way."
She smiled.
"My own way," she said. "Yes, my own way."
"Did Eleanor ever offer her slaves understanding or comfort?"
Laurent pressed.
"Did Eleanor ever grasp the power of loving discipline rather than severity and disdain?"
Beauty smiled.
"No, you're right. She never did understand the subtleties."
"Beauty," he said as he bent to kiss her. "Be the queen of Bellavaultin in your own way."
"It was enough for now, wasn't it?"
She nodded. She put her hand into Laurent's hand. No sooner had they stepped into the council chamber, and no sooner had those gathered there risen to bow and to greet them, than she was the confident and smiling queen once more.
"Bellavaultin," she thought, "how deeply I do love you." And how very odd, wasn't it,
that she had no doubt that Bellavaultin loved her in return. Chapter 11. Beauty, a story of the Old Kingdom. The enigmatic Lexius, tall, slender, dark-skinned, and dark-eyed, the silken and seductive steward of the Sultan, whom Laurent had brought back to Bellavaultin as a slave, was indeed coming. Two letters reached the kingdom before he did, and it was the opinion of Alexei that Lexius might arrive at any moment.
"Of course I want to hear the whole story," said Laurent. "What did he do? What do you mean he broke the old queen's heart?"
Beauty walked down the long corridor with Laurent, her left hand on his right hand, both of them sumptuously dressed for yet another day of official decisions, but headed now to a small hall where they could meet only with the inner circle, so to speak, Alexei, Dmitri, Rosalind, Elena, and the indispensable Lady Eva. No important meeting took place without the attendance of Lady Eva, busy as she might be with the postulant slaves and the novices. "If some scandal surrounds this man, we should know of it," Beauty affirmed. "And I know, my lord, how he's always fascinated you."
"And you mean to say, lovely one, that he didn't fascinate you?" asked Laurent.
He was cheerful, in good spirits as always. He woke each single morning with a new enthusiasm for life, fully embracing his priapic duties with a stamina that amazed Beauty. But then Laurent's stamina, in all forms, had always amazed Beauty, she had to admit, so why was she surprised at this? "Yes, he fascinates me," said Beauty, "but I was never drawn to him once you made him your plaything. But as I said, we must find out what actually happened." It was a lovely day of balmy breezes and blue skies, with only a thin mist streaking the sky over the valley here and there, and likely to burn off by noon. All was well with the realm. But yesterday had been an exhausting day for the monarchs, with many audiences and decisions to be made. Three returning grooms, dismissed by the late queen, had asked for an audience.
and the court had heard their plea along with the petitions of others for hours on end. Two beautiful, dark-skinned African eunuchs had come to the kingdom, begging for sanctuary, so to speak. And a strange and mighty northern lord appeared with two naked slaves trained by him in a remote castle, whom he wanted to sell to the kingdom for their own good. Artists and merchants petitioned to be admitted to the villages and hamlets. So many different matters to consider. Beauty was happy today to be meeting only with the small council, and she greeted those standing about the table with genuine warmth.
"Well, be seated all," Laurent said. "Let's have some cider, if you will, and perhaps some sweetmeats, and get to talking straight away about Lexius."
Laurent took the head of the table and Beauty the chair to his right. Alexei sat down opposite Beauty, with Dimitri beside him, and the ladies across from one another after that. Lady Eva settled at the foot of the table with her quill and ink, and bound book for note-taking. "So what is all the mystery?" asked Beauty. At once the others looked to Alexei, and he, seeing this, made a small, graceful gesture of acceptance with both hands. He looked most beautiful this morning to Beauty, with his auburn hair now considerably longer than it had been at their first meeting, a prince from a tapestry in her mind. And, as always, he was impeccably turned out in the finest patterned silk tunic and adornments that suggested the treasures of Byzantium. No one devoted to the new kingdom had given any more passion and devotion than Alexei, not even Dimitri, who worked tirelessly every day to refine the place of public punishment, or Lady Eva herself, or even Rosalind and Elena, who were in charge of the nightly spectacles in the castle gardens. Beauty had a special love for these two sisters who'd shared captivity in the Sultanate, and she found them most appealing. Rosalind, in her mind, had attained the pinnacle of buxom voluptuousness, whereas the smaller, more delicate Elena was a clever-tongued, tasty sylph with high-pointed breasts and a low, purring voice that delighted Beauty.
"I shall be spokesman, then. Why not?" said Alexei, raising his eyebrows and settling against the carved back of the chair. "I'll tell what I know, but some things I do not know, and perhaps others here will be inspired by my candor." "What the hell happened?" asked Laurent, with a little wink and smile. "Get to it. We're bound together night after night in the hold of the ship that brought us back here, he and I. Bound by our delicious desires. I probably did more to train him than anyone who came after."
That produced a low, respectful bit of laughter from everyone.
"Well, I think you did," said Alexei. "As you know, he was brought before the queen, accepted reluctantly because the queen would not have anyone choose slavery of his own will, and then packed off to the kitchen. But the report soon came upstairs that he was wilting like a lily under the coarse treatment of the servants, and ought to be tended with more care. So she sent for him."
He paused and shrugged.
"I was her favorite, as everyone knew," he said, his voice philosophical rather than mocking. "And I can't say I was delighted to see him absorb so much of her attention." "Of course not," said Laurent, with a gesture for Alexei to continue. "Well, she had time enough for both of us," said Alexei. "And Lexius was as abject and servile as any naked slave who ever kissed the queen's slippers. He was graceful by instinct, and knew subtleties of service that no one can teach. He had a lissom charm and an eloquence and ignominy that was breathtaking. Of course, I did with him what I had done before with others. I seduced him while the queen slept and proved a harsher master than she was a mistress." "Ah, so that's how it was with you two," said Laurent. "Yes," said Alexei. "Lexius taught me how to master him and his submission. We had to be careful, of course. The old queen forbade all such trysts among her slaves, though they happened throughout the castle nightly, and he and I were never caught. Meanwhile, the queen delighted in talking about how Lexius had once been a powerful steward of slaves under his former master, the Sultan, and constantly demanded he offer up to her refinements and innovations in the ways slaves should be displayed and used at court. And he was more than willing to do it. Then at night he became my adoring attendant. Well, all this might have gone on for years and years, but the captain of the guard came up and informed the queen that the Sultanate was in grave danger, and almost certain to be destroyed. Soldiers had heard the rumors from the sailors putting in, and soon the queen confirmed the worst. A powerful army was gathering to invade the Sultanate and other realms like it. The captain of the guard was adamant that if he were to rescue Dimitri, Rosalind, and Elena, he had to have Lexius with him. Lexius knew the Sultanate after his years there. He could find a way for the captain to accomplish the rescue speedily, and speed was of the utmost importance. So the queen had Lexius groomed and dressed from head to toe and armed for battle. Lexius was well acquainted with weapons and swore to assist the captain in every possible way, and off they went at once to the docks to board the ship for the secretive mission. Well, you can imagine what this must have been like for Lexius, who for 2 years at least had been a naked plaything. Here he was once again possessed of the implements of power. He and the captain accomplished the mission, with only a few nights to spare, and before they even returned, the Sultanate was destroyed utterly. Lexius and the captain had both warned the Sultan of what was to come, by letters left for him, which he would not receive until they were safely away with their charges. But whether that was of any help at all, no one ever knew. The Sultanate was obliterated, and the custom of pleasure slavery was stamped out in that land forever, though not by persons who had the slightest interest in it. It simply fell out that way.
"And so you were all brought back at that time," Beauty said. She paused and looked at Dimitri.
"Yes, my queen," Dimitri said. "It was all quite sudden. To be immersed in the village again was quite sudden."
Rosalind and Elena laughed knowingly, and Elena shook her head. "Go on, Alexei," said Beauty.
"Well, I did not before this time think the old queen had loved Lexius, but I should have known that she did. And when he returned, when he brought these slaves back to her feet, I should have observed more carefully the way that she looked at him. Picture it, if you will. Here, this languid, sinewy, and feline man who'd been her naked doll, and suddenly, there he was before her in a long black velvet tunic, purloined from the fallen Sultanate, trimmed with magnificent designs, his fingers covered in massive rings, his jeweled sword belt girdling his waist, and his weapon now not the broad sword he'd taken with him, but a gleaming scimitar. He brought the slaves to her in golden collars and chains, and making her a magnificent bow, assured her that they had offered complete compliance in their rescue."
"How fortunate for them," said Laurent with a laugh.
"Yes. Well, I should have seen her black eyes devouring him, devouring all the delicious aspects of his person, his seductive Eastern dignity. But I didn't see it. Well, she said that having such pampered and spoiled slaves returned to court wouldn't do, and that Lexius was to take them down to the village and see they were appropriately worked and punished there so that all the cloying softness was removed from them. Lexius was to remain in the village at Jennifer Loxley's inn and watch over them daily. She said a month or two would be sufficient for Lexius to ensure that things were being done properly, and then he was to return to her. But in the meantime, he might make himself entirely comfortable in the inn and do whatever he liked."
"Ah," said Beauty. "What a stunning idea. So he would enjoy this freedom, this privilege, and then come back to her naked and abject.
Yes, that is it exactly, said Alexei. But how much Her Majesty understood of what she was doing here is not clear. She wanted total obedience, and that seemed her emphasis. And maybe she thought this time in the village was some sort of reward to Lexius for his bravery in journeying to the Sultanate on the eve of war. I mean, she wanted to reward him in some way.
Alexei shifted in his chair. He was speaking almost entirely to Beauty now, but didn't seem to realize it. But Beauty realized it. And as always, she loved to watch the shifting expressions of his face. And she loved the tone of his voice.
Anyway, down to the village, Lexius went with plenty of her gold,
Alexei said.
And so went Dmitri and Elena and Rosalind to be punished there. All were sent initially to the stables, but Lexius had leave to take them out of harness at any time and subject them to the public turntable, the punishment shop, or whatever he thought appropriate. Now, the mayor at that time was the only keeper of female ponies in the village, and his stable was much smaller and infinitely more elegant than the public stable. But you know all this, of course.
Well, it was a new sight for Lexius. And he fell in love with the high style of the harnesses, the plumes, the golden bits and shapely boots worn by the female ponies. And so did Elena and Rosalind. Alexei paused and looked to them for confirmation.
Oh, absolutely, said Rosalind. It was superb, all of it, and the stable, small as it was, all polished and shining, more like a great, how shall I say, stage setting, perhaps, than a real place. And the grooms were magnificent, big, powerful boys with huge hands and loving voices. We had such